So it's going to be a multimedia presentation because I couldn't get all of my micrographs into my laptop this morning. So I brought some of them on, some of them are in the PowerPoint presentation, and some of them I'll have to turn on the transparency for. Okay, so what Dave asked me to talk about was kink bans, which I'm quite happy to do. But I'm also going to talk about, if there's time at the end, about lamellar contraction and solvent-induced non-equilibrium morphologies. So before I forget, the work you're going to see is primarily the work from two different graduate students, Dan Paulus and Lei Xiao, and that's where they currently are, and then collaborators, Dave, and I will defer a number of questions, any hard questions will be deferred to Dave, Tony Ryan for access to the synchrotron for some of the experiments, and then a variety of guys at the Darsbury Lab, including Ian, who I don't see this morning. And then the last bit of project was materials were provided by Dow. All right, so here's the outline and many of the main findings. So for kink bans, I'll just start off by saying what they are, how they get initiated, the dynamics of the kink bands, and this is the work with Dave with the lamellar rotation mechanism. And then just as an aside, the fact that we also see rotation in the lamellae matrix. I'll talk about how the kink bands die, how they terminate through this glycopolymer boundary transformation, and then how they relax. So this might be interesting as well, because they look like they're relaxing into focal conics, although now that I know what oily streaks are, maybe they're going into oily streaks. Leave that for now. And then for lamellar contraction, we've looked at contraction as a function of both molecular weight and shear rate, and there seems to be a strong correlation with the applied stress. And then the last bit of the talk, I'll talk about solvent-induced morphologies, where we've developed non-equilibrium morphologies by using selective solvents. Okay, so for kink bands, the vast majority of what I'm going to say about kink bands is going to be involving the styrene ethylene propylene diblock copolymer, so it's a diblock, in the strong intermediate to strong segregation limit. Okay. Yep. So in the kink bands, it'll be a diblock. And the materials are in the intermediate or strong segregation limit. So we won't have any of what we talked about yesterday of the molecules jumping between layers. That's way longer than the time scales of the experiment because of the strong segregation limit. Most of the experiments will be done at steady shear, and I'll note when I'm doing oscillatory shear instead. And most of the experiments have started off with a predominantly parallel alignment. So there is a lot of work on using large amplitude oscillatory shear to create parallel orientation. So now we just use that insight to create the predominantly parallel starting state and go from there. All right, so now I got to flip this up because it's OK. I don't mind. So. Oops. So. Nope, that's what this is here. Yeah, okay. So this is what a kink band is. The top one is in a rock, and that's a coin for size scale. And this is it in a lamellar diblock copolymer, where the lamellae started off in a predominantly parallel starting state. So it's kind of cool that these differ by, you know, four orders of magnitude in size. But what we really start off with is, so the alternating colors here are the styrene ethylene propylene lamellae. We're looking along the neutral direction. The shearing is in the, I always shear to the right. Shear to the right across the top of the image. All right, so the way we define a kink band is we have these, you know, nearly parallel rows of tilt boundaries, and the tilt boundaries are sharp. So the lamellae come in, turn a corner, and then regain their initial orientation. Right? So that's the type of defect we're talking about.
Sorry, maybe this is know, pushing things a little far, but the upper picture.
The upper picture is a silicate.
Totally different physics, right? There's no.
Well, it's a silicate. So there's a silicate layer, and then there's a clay layer. So there's, you know, more slip than less slip. It's a layered structure. The thing is, you have no idea what the you have no idea what the load was that created this.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So I'm not sure it's entirely different.
Okay.
It's layered. There's slip. But you know, here we can control the type of load that the system has.
King band at the bottom right-hand side.
Yep. 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 Right. So we call this a
same direction.
Yep. Right. So this, the kink bands, have by and large the same second orientation. So we have a primary orientation from the predominantly parallel starting state, and we have a secondary orientation from the stuff inside the kink band. All right.
What about the orientation of the interface?
That is close to 45 degrees. We don't see a lot of variation in this angle. And the width in most of our experiments is on the order of half a micron to a micron. All right.
Do you ever see kinks pointing to the vorticity direction?
No. We've actually looked, and the images are very hard to distinguish, because if you look at a plane coming this way, there's just, this is going to have a different sort of periodicity, you know, because you're looking at it from this direction. So those images are hard to interpret. There's one other thing. Oh, and we call these forward kink bands because we're shearing to the right and they're tilted to the right. And that's as it should be. It'd be really hard to think about forming a kink band, a reverse kink band.
These are 2D though. They come.
Right. Right. Now, we don't know much about what their shape is, but I've always imagined that they're like airplane wings.
Related question about the orientation of the airplane wing. I probably asked this before, but do you ever see a change of spacing inside the kink band that might be attributed to
right.
Vehicles?
Okay. So in our first paper looking at isolated kink bands from a predominantly parallel starting state, we detected a contraction out here and a dilation here, which is fine because you'd imagine that there's tension in that direction. Now, measuring spacings off of a TEM is a delicate thing because if you're not cutting in exactly the right orientation, you can be misled because it's a projection. When we did the experiments in the small angle X-ray scattering machine, we saw no difference. We saw the periodicity here did not change relative to the starting state. Now, that could just be the resolution of the instrument because on the kink bands, we only have the second or third order. Up here, we see out to the eighth or ninth order, and then we can see contraction here, but we can't say whether this is dilating or contracting or staying the same. Okay. All right, but if you read one of the earlier papers, we say contraction and dilation, and that's from an electron microscopy experiment.
Okay, I guess I should have thought of this previously, but is it geometrically possible to have the normal to the kink bands lie outside of the plane of that picture? Or is the normal to the layers in? Have you ever thought about whether whether it's possible to have the whole, you know, rather than having a kink band that's like this, to have
right.
the layers in the kink band pointed at some
I'm much more comfortable thinking about this as a two-dimensional object.
It's a lot simpler.
Yeah. Yeah. And that suits me fine. I mean, I really can't rationalize why it would go.
Well, if it were substantially tilted up, you wouldn't see it at all in X-ray. So the fact that you can see something associated with a ticking thing in X-ray means it's normal. It has to be at least reasonably close. Right.
And if the normal tilted a whole lot out of here, this spacing would be more dramatically different.
That's actually what I was getting at.
Yeah.
That's pretty strong evidence that it is 2D.
Right. Right. Pat, did...
The original alignment was by oscillatory shear. There was a steady shear applied to make the kink band.
Correct. Oscillatory shear, anneal, and then steady shear. Now, if we go backwards, we make these go away. And if we go all the way backwards, we make them going in the other direction. So we can make forward kink bands in that direction if we shear in that direction. So.
How much total strain have you introduced here?
I believe this one's 40 or 80%.
If you zoom out, is there any periodicity to the kink bands themselves?
They kind of cluster. And wow, Wes, you're right. You told me I should have thrown out half my slides. So the reason we think they cluster is because the residual defects in the predominantly parallel state cluster. So that's what a kink band is. Chevron type boundaries in parallel.
Are there any band ends?
Oh, the kink band ends. I'll show you in a couple.
This is just a short instant of time.
Excuse me?
That picture is obviously just an instant of time, but I mean, if we keep shearing it, what happens?
Gotta hold on for that answer. Okay.
Sorry, one last question. The undulations in the lower half of that thing.
Oh, these?
Do you typically find that bumpiness after the band, or just?
Well, that's a hard thing to interpret. It's a hard thing to interpret because it's cut and this thin microtome section might not be perfectly flat. What we can tell from the in situ X-ray experiments is that the peak that's corresponding to the predominantly parallel does not get significantly broader. Yeah, but it'd be really nice if there were undulations there. I agree with that. But, okay, so let's talk about how they initiate. So we believe they initiate from residual defects. So this is our predominantly parallel starting state. And we picked a section that looked particularly non-ideal. So we got some stuff not parallel over there, then we got some bending over here. And we think that it's these regions of non-parallel orientation that nucleate the kink bands. And the better image to demonstrate that is the one on the bottom here. So it's hard to find the kink bands, the ends of the kink bands, where they just end in the middle of space. They typically end at a variety of types of defects. So now this is only 30% strain, but you can see there's a couple edge dislocations here. And then to get around the edge dislocation, the predominantly parallel stuff would have to kind of meld around. And then at 30% strain, we call these S boundaries because they're not real sharp yet. All right. But you can kind of see them going over and coming back. All right. And this is just another image of a starting state. Right, so various edge dislocations here, right? And we see these in clumps, and then when we shear, we see the kink bands in clumps. And it appears that you need two things to get a kink band started. You need some local misorientation, typically around a defect, and you need some critical amount of strain. Because at lower strains, you haven't quite formed kink bands yet. You just kind of have this more gently varying lamellae. All right. So a residual defect and a critical strain to actually get those sharp boundaries.
Your first picture actually showed what looked like the end, a fairly smooth ending of the kink.
I think it just fades off the edge of the...
Yeah.
Well, this is a steeper, right? This is a steeper step, right? And then towards the end, but there's going to have to be an extra plane up there somewhere or another defect.
Why does it create an extra plane up there?
Well, because, this is.
Counting.
Yeah, you got to count it. You can't just.
Okay, there's something else that happened up there.
Yeah. Okay. All righty. So the other evidence that we have that it takes a residual defect to make a kink band is here. So we, these are from in situ shearing and scattering experiments. And I'll talk more about that experiment in a few minutes. But now just take my word for it that this hump over here is related to the kink bands. All right. So we have a, this is our zero strain. I didn't put the strains on here. This is 0% strain, 0, 20, 40, 60. There should be up to 80. Anyway, from 0 to 80% strain. 4, 6, 8, 8.5. Okay, so from 0% strain to 80% strain, you can see we have a predominantly parallel starting state, and this hump, which is the kink band population, is moving off to the right. So it by no means is the dominant morphological feature. It's an isolated, it's a defect, right? There aren't that many of them. Now, if we add to the sample before we do the alignment, half a volume percent of half micron silica spheres, we see that the magnitude of this hump is bigger. Right? So then when we go in and we look at the electron microscopy, we also just see, you know, qualitatively more kink bands as well.
Question.
Yeah.
What's the layer spacing? The distance?
70 nanometers.
Aren't the kink bands nucleated on one of these balls?
Well, you know, if they're airplane wings and they're nucleating on a ball, I'm not sure we would know it. Because if they're like this, and we look at the image out here, we won't know whether it's actually nucleated just because of the, they are three-dimensional images. Yeah, we'd love to know that, but we don't. Okay, so this is our other bit of evidence to say that they start at defects. Residual defects predominant. Okay, we already saw this one. This is the one where the critical strain is the S boundary. I already showed you those images. Okay. So now we can also get conjugate kink bands. So this is an as molded sample, and we didn't do the original alignment. We just went ahead and sheared the living daylights out of it. So a 40% strain, sorry, that's strain, not that high of a temperature, but we sheared it for 12 hours, thinking that that would get the thing aligned. All right. So now, this is actually the first paper on kink bands where we started from an unaligned starting state and used oscillatory shear. And when you use oscillatory shear, you get these, this double population of kink bands. You get forward and forward. You know, we don't get forward in reverse. You get forward because you're shearing that direction. You get forward in the other direction as well. Okay, so let me just talk about what we see here. These are parallel lamellae. These are perpendicular, parallel, perpendicular, right? So here again, parallel into the, parallel and transverse orientation, parallel and transverse orientation.
Does the picture depend on, you're applying 40% strain.
So right.
Does the picture you see depend on what, where on the cycle you stop?
Our rheometer only lets us stop at zero. But I mean, we've gone for 12 hours. I mean, we've done gazillion, you know, cycles.
Well, I guess I'm wondering if the vertical ones over the course of the cycle are going like this, or if they, you know, they remain.
Well, I actually think in the oscillatory shear, they're getting stuck. So when I said earlier that they were reversible, if they're isolated, you can undo them. But if you shear extensively and they start butting into one another, then I don't think they can be reversible anymore. I don't think you can unwind them. So this image is a little bit easier to understand if we look at a blow-up of that. I'm doing large amplitude oscillatory shear.
So can you describe in Europe with your hands what's happening with this picture when you're doing a huge strain in one direction?
Right. Okay, so the strain is 40%, and what I imagine is that the strain is far from uniform. So, but that's about all the further I get.
Yeah, but you know, what's happening with those? effect as you're staining the material?
There might be a little bit of rocking in the transverse orientations, but they're not going back to parallel.
I think there is. So,
well, if okay, so let's go to the rest of the data first. So now remember that the first set of kink bands I showed you basically grew out of isolated defects, and I sheared in one direction. That's about the simplest shear experiment we could do. This experiment is probably the most complex. We had a gazillion, you know, it was defect full when we started, and we sheared it extensively, you know, 12 hours, 40% strain. So I imagine that these kink bands have run into each other and gotten stuck. Whoop. Thanks. So this is a blow up of that box. And you can see that in some regions the boundaries are, the lamellae are continuous across the tilt boundaries, and some they are not. So we can see both of those. And then if we take this image, is now just here, we can see that the kink bands, there's both one's pointed in this direction and one's pointed in this direction. So this goes back to Fred's question. They kind of look like they're at plus and minus 45 degrees. And they also look like they're kind of banded, right? So there's this top half is all tilted left, and there's this section here tilted right, and then these are tilted left again. So when I imagine doing oscillatory shear on this, that, you know, the strain is going to be very inhomogeneous. All right. So the reason we were able to get, so also if you've followed the literature on trying to get block copolymers well aligned, this is the coexistence of the parallel and transverse orientation, and, you know, so now we know how those two populations coexist.
In this system, is the rheology of each layer similar?
Well, okay, so the styrene is 40,000, so the interpenetration zone is barely entangled, but we're above the glass, and we're above the glass transition to polystyrene. The ethylene propylene is well above its glass transition temperature, but there is some entanglement in that interpenetration zone between the polyethylene. So if you think about where the chains are, we have unentangled styrene and well-entangled ethylene propylene, but if you think of those relaxations, I'm not sure how different they would be. But that's a question we just don't know the answer to.
If you were to look at pure amounts of each block, which one would have higher viscosity at the same temperature?
Actually, the ethylene propylene, which when we first did that, I was quite surprised. Because the styrene, you want to compare it with the homopolymer of the entire block or the homopolymer that's in the interpenetration zone? I don't remember for the entire block, because I usually think about it as just the interpenetration zone, because that's how you transfer load from one block to the next. So if this is untangled, then I imagine that the styrenes are just going like this past one another, where the ethylene propylenes are entangled, so there actually will be some viscous dissipation there.
Interpenetrations on your estimates somehow, or what fraction of the spacing is
it? Right. So the way we estimate that is with the, I'm not sure I'm going to get their names in the right order, Witten, Leibler, Pincus. Pincus, you know, some combination of those three names allows us, I mean, it was an estimate, but to calculate what that interpenetration zone was.
And it's 50%.
Of by thickness.
Yeah.
No, it's much less. It's much less. So for the styrene not to be entangled, and if we consider the entanglement molecular weight to be, you know, 15,000, and it's not entangled. All right. So less than a quarter of the styrene block. This is 40,000. Less than a quarter of that styrene block is in the interpenetration zone. Okay, so these are conjugate kink bands. And this is what you get when you start with many defects and you use a lot of oscillatory shear. This was too complicated to study, so then we went back to the predominantly parallel starting state.
You said that some of the kink bands, for instance, some of the kink bands in lamella go across the band and others they don't, and you've got a mismatch.
Well, they break. Some of them have broken.
So you mean that there's just a different number of planes on one side than the other? There's a defect on the band or something?
Well, actually, this looks incredibly pixelated, but it can be that there's exactly the same number on both sides and they're just fractured.
So it's just looking at these pictures, it does seem to be twisted across the boundary. I mean, the wavelength looks different on
the layer spacing looks different on. Yeah. Well. Remember, these have been microtomed, and they've been microtomed with a particular direction, so we can get selective compression. So, yeah, and the early papers say that there's contraction in here and dilation in there, but the X-ray scattering doesn't bear that out. Yeah. Yeah, and the X-rays in situ, remember, these have all been sheared at high temperature and then quenched. Okay, let me see what's next. All right, now we're done with this. We can go to that for a little while. All right, so now we're going to talk. So that's how kink bands get started and how they're different if you do steady shear or oscillatory shear. Now we want to talk about the dynamics of just the forward kink bands, not the conjugate kink bands. And from geology, there's kind of these two schemes. And we had reason to believe that this was more likely because we didn't really see the width of these change. You know, regardless of whether we'd strained 40% or twice as much, 80%, they're always about half a micron wide. We didn't see this considerable, you know, this is a kink band then that spontaneously forms in the middle of something perfect, right? And then it grows like that. And that didn't seem consistent with the ex situ electron microscopy experiments.
Have you gotten more than 80%?
Yes, but that we'll talk about that when we get to termination. Right. So right now we're just going to do the dynamics on this, you know, after they've initiated, before they've started to die. Okay. So to do these experiments, we went to Darsbury. It's the same sort of block copolymer. We use oscillatory shear to get it predominantly parallel to starting with. Our starting state, and then we shear at a variety of rates in one direction. And so it turns out that this particular starting state had some residual kink bands in it, and that was a blessing in disguise. And you can see that because here, so this is the third is weak and the sixth is weak. So that's the second order, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and you can see 7 and 8 as well if you change the contrast color scale. All right, so you can see by looking at that colored one that the azimuthal intensity is not symmetric around the parallel orientation, that there's a shoulder, right? And it's that shoulder that gives, that corresponds to these kink bands. All right, so now we can actually watch. So now I shear up. So this is different than the orientation before. So this is the predominantly parallel starting, 2, 3 is weak, 6 is weak, there's 7 and 8. And we're going to shear, this is wrong. We're going to shear this direction. All right. So this is just a series of, all right. So you can see in this fourth order reflection that this peak is broken off and it's rotating around. And now we're going to shear back. So we go out to 80% and then now we're coming back. All right. Yeah, it's not changing significantly with regard to its distance from the center. So that means the periodicity of the lamellae inside the kink band versus outside the kink band are not changing dramatically. So let me just show it to you in this color scheme as well, because now you can see it in the second order, right? So there's this little blue bump, blue and light blue bump that comes over, because it's actually the second order reflection that we look at. And then now we're shearing backwards and just comes back. All right, so the reason this experiment is doable is because our starting state had some kink bands in it. And that gave us this asymmetry in our initial profile, and then as we sheared, that asymmetry went further.
Karen?
Yeah.
Just a qualitative question. Yeah, I find it remarkable that you look at the micrographs and you see these very nice boundaries and sort of discrete things, and then in the X-ray, you have sort of broad peaks and shoulders, and do you think this is just on larger scales than you can look at with the TEM? You just have variations.
Absolutely, because if you look at a bunch of different kink bands from exactly the same sample, the population of lamellae that are inside the kink band aren't all at the same orientation. Right. So there's some which are, this angle is not identical in every sample, in every kink within a given sample. How much is this tilted down?
So
that's what gives rise to this breadth.
You've done microscopy where you've sort of looked at rotation.
Right. And there's always a spread.
Yeah.
And that's what you would expect if they were spontaneously growing out of perfect parallel lamellae, then you might expect them to be identical. But if they're nucleating off of pre-existing defects, of which there's a zoology, then you'd expect there to be a range of angles. So now this is that two-dimensional data reduced. This is just the integration around the second order reflection. You can see this wild original distribution. So we have our predominantly parallel stuff and then this stuff related to the kink band. And as we shear, we see a couple things. First of all, the kink band population increases, that angle increases with strain, which suggests lamellar rotation. The rate of rotation decreases with strain. So these are even steps in strain, but the steps, it moves quickly and then it slows down.
It's slowing down around 90 degrees.
Yeah. And then the area under the kink band is fairly uniform. So we're not spontaneously forming, twice as many kink bands. A lot of it depends on how we'll initially define this shoulder here. Right.
You can fit, Lay actually fit that hump.
Right. Giving away the good part. Anyway, so qualitative, these are the things we can say. It's the peak is moving, the lamellae within the kink band. So that red arrow corresponds to the red stuff here. And as we shear, they roll over more. The rate at which they roll over slows down, but it looks like the population in there is not changing dramatically. Okay, so.
Sorry, in that previous picture, I'm just confused by the little drawing on the right.
Yeah.
You're shearing like that, the bands are going this way.
Oh, this defines an angle relative to the top.
Time is up.
Time goes up.
Right.
Thank you. That's all I want to know.
More and more strain. Okay.
I like relativity. I just thought I'd fail to understand something.
Thank you for. Yeah.
Have you done analysis of TEM with the same distribution of angles to see whether there's a parallel?
So actually, when we talk about termination, we certainly see this angle move as we strain, and we do see it move past 90 degrees. So.
Don't have, analysis of TEM distribution.
Correct. Right. Down. Okay. So, actually, before we did those experiments, Dave had written us a personal communication with equations in it, which I'm now going to qualitatively describe for you. So the assumptions in the model, and I've got better drawings on the next slide, but the assumptions in the model are that the kink band is already formed. So there's well-defined kink bands, and that the boundary region, that it changes orientations over a short distance, right? And that the deformation's homogeneous across the boundaries. And what this does is say that the slip here is negligible when the boundaries are narrow. So let's go to the better schematics. All right. So the model is for kink bands that are already well formed with these narrow tilt boundaries. And the first thing we need to figure out was whether or not, what Dave needed to figure out, was whether or not these boundaries, whether the boundary moved, whether this boundary moved like that in response to shear. Right. So what this drawing represents is to get the boundary to move from the solid set of lines to the dotted set of lines. So that's what we're talking about, this boundary migration. Another way to think about that change is to think about shifting the solid lines down from the solid to the dotted here, and from up from the solid to the dotted up on the right-hand side. All right, and that corresponds to a tangential slip. And if there's tangential slip, then the boundary moves. So if there's tangential slip, the boundary moves. But if the boundary is sharp, we don't expect there to be tangential slip, because that would require, you know, styrene to meet ethylene propylene.
The sharp boundary in the upper left is defined how the width of those, the separation between those.
Well, so in the microscopy, this region is comparable to the periodicity of the lamellae, and thus small. Yeah.
And there's, Duchenne and Crow's book, there is a model for these kinds of chevron boundaries in which you have a bookshelf structure in which you fix the angles at infinity and ask how wide then this will be confined to. And it involves the symmetric penetration depth and, you know, over the angle cubed or something. It's wider when the angle is low, but there's a well-defined width of those boundaries. It's only a few layer spaces.
It depends on the angle you impose.
Yeah, I think it's wider
as
the angle gets.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
But the interface thickness of the lamellar thickness, but there are two lengths there.
Lamellar thickness, the lamellae periodicity.
So experimentally, it's of order the lamellar thickness.
Right, I understand. But
theoretically, it's related to the symmetric penetration depth,
which is
not that different from the symmetric spacing in these systems.
Okay. So by this insight, in the absence of tangential slip, the boundaries can't migrate. The kink bands can't get fatter or skinnier. Where the tilt boundaries are stays in place. So then the rate at which the stuff inside rotates can be given by this cosine squared. Right. So the rate at which it rotates is dependent on the shear rate, the macroscopic shear rate, and on the angle that it's currently at. All right. So we can see that the ramifications of that here. So if we have some initial distribution of kink band angles, and we evolve them using this model, that population of kink bands transforms into that at half a strain unit, and then 1 and 2 and 3. And we see the same qualitative features that we saw in the experimental data, right? So the maximum of this peak is moving off to the right. The rate at which it moves slows down, and the area under the peak stays constant. We put that part in, right? We didn't allow kink bands to be born or to die.
The fact that the boundaries don't migrate also means that the kink band width is rigorously constant for each individual kink band.
And these bands are going to flip over eventually. I mean, this rate goes to zero at 180 mu over 2.
Yes. They get stretched out into an infinitely long z. We're not infinitely long.
Right.
Z eventually.
Right. But actually, we won't apply the model to that extreme, because there's a, something else happens when they die, right? This, so this is just for the middle region after they're initiated, before they die. Okay, so, yeah?
I'm still on a geometry problem. You're looking at by the migration, what you mean by the rotation.
Oops, sir. All right.
The material in the King Bank is constant amount.
Right. So
all the mass is conserved inside that parallelogram.
Right. Right.
As I'm shearing it, I'm stretching the length of the layers.
Well.
How do they conserve the volume?
The band changes orientation.
Just rotate. Really.
Yeah.
I'm talking about this is two-dimensional cross section. So.
Right.
Is the area constant under the what is constant under what I'm doing?
This area, this area has got to stay constant because we don't add or delete layers. The layer periodicity is constant.
But they can move relative. Can't the boundaries move relative to each other?
Well, that requires tangential slip.
So then is the length. So how do I conserve the area of the parallelogram? Do we make it longer and smaller spacing, or what was going on?
I'm just realizing that there is a problem.
Well, no, it's exactly, okay, so first of all, the geometry she's describing is exactly the same. The way I like to describe it is you take three decks of cards, and you tape together pairs of cards, right? So that is, you know, I imagine I take three cards, and we'll put them into a string, and taking together, and make a stack of these things. And then I just shove these two decks of cards together, and the middle one rotates, those cards are sliding past each other and rotating. And the volume of that middle deck of cards is conserved. One thing that does happen, though, is that the spacing, you have to be careful about which one, the spacing between the cards is constant, measured normal to the cards, but it's not constant measured along the kink bed.
Right. So the other piece is in the model, the strain here is equal and opposite of what the strain is within the layers here. So these cards are moving relative to one another, but their card periodicity is not changing.
So the layers are being compressed in that?
No.
Mm. No. The drawing makes it look like the layers
are
being compressed.
Yeah.
Not only.
No, but the model explicitly assumes a constant layer space.
I don't think I've got a better drawing.
The reason I like to talk about the deck of cards is because you can visualize it and you know it's a constant layer space.
Right,
just
and
then working out the math.
And then deck of cards would be 52 cards, it would be many cards.
But for a fixed number
okay.
Number of cards or layers.
Michael's satisfied. He nodded, so we'll move on. We'll take that as a sign. Now Carrie's lost.
The area of the parallelogram. If you keep the length constant and the thickness constant, it is constant. All you're doing is you're making the side thing longer. What's really changing here is the side, the length of, think about it, just one parallelogram, one spacing.
But it's times
the
height is the same.
The height is the same, the length is the same. All you're changing is the length of the side. The two parallel sides and two other parallel sides. The two red sides are changing length.
Well, if I take a fixed number of, the two boundaries are moving together through this rotation process, but if I take a fixed number of layers and I measure the length of the kink band parallel to the regular boundaries, the whole a fixed number of layers corresponds to a larger distance measured along the boundaries. So the spacing between the APMs, which is how like, the area ends up being.
David, in your deck of cards analogy, if you only kinked the middle, say, third of the stack, this rotation, you're forced to move defects above and below. Is the dragging of defects or the motion important?
In this model, the kink bands have no ends.
Yeah,
which didn't work.
Yeah, so in reality, there are problems at the ends of the kink bands because this is changing height difference relative to this. And that can't happen in a fixed gap, in a perfect fixed gap experiment. But That's okay.
That's, those are dislocations, though? That's
the right. I mean, yeah, there's defects. There's enough defects to compensate for that. But the model doesn't. The model is like this. Okay. So this is the experimental data I showed you earlier for the 0.1 strain unit. We arbitrarily, or, you know, we select a initial distribution of the kink bands. Yeah, we select that red curve to describe the population of angles, you know, corresponding to the kink bands. And then after that, everything is determined by Dave's model, right? So if this population of kink band angles evolves with the cosine squared law, then that is how the kink bands develop. All right. So there is some arbitrary nature in the initial pick, but then after that, it's all predetermined by the model.
What happens with this red curve as you keep on going and go to the scale of 2000 or something?
Well, it gets you know, infinitely narrow and infinitely tall, and eventually gets over to 100, 180.
It stops.
Now, the model can't be applied that high because they're no longer kink bands at that point, but that'll be in a minute. So at 0.1, the fastest strain rate we did, the fit is amazingly good. But as we sheared slower, you can see that the model is getting ahead of the data. The model's getting ahead of the data because we're not allowing for any sorts of, you know, relaxation. So if we shear more slow, you can see where, you know, the rotation within the kink bands might not be keeping up with the deck of card model.
Karen, were you just fortunate that the hump appeared on the side of the distribution that you decided to shear? Or did you decide to shear in the direction that you saw a hump?
Well, no, we were just lucky. Yeah, we were just lucky. This was a sample. This was a sample from heaven because we had tried just to get a very nice starting distribution, but we ended up with this shoulder.
Once you rule out boundary migration, there's no dynamics in the model. It's pure kinematics. So everything depends entirely on the strain, and obviously the answer depends somewhat on the strain rate.
So, Karen, your comment suggests an experiment where you do like a step or a rapid strain and watch the relaxation.
Oh, well. Yeah, well, we'll talk about relaxation in a minute. Okay. So, you know, we now know that the lamellae within the kink band are rotating, and they can be described by this. It's certainly accurate at the highest shear rates, but at the lower shear rates, there are some domain relaxations.
But the gradient of the curve was still the same, even though they were moving slower, up at the top, yeah.
Yeah, so the starting curve.
The experimental curve above, do they disappear, or is the area under the curve the same?
The area under the curve is not that different if we fit these experimentally. I mean, so we did this two ways. We fit the initial curve with some approximation for the kink band population, and we worked it this way. And then we also fit this and worked it back the other way. And that seemed to be, it seemed to be more reasonable to do it this way. But it just kind of gave you a weirder, it missed this part of the population, if I remember correctly.
But the area under the curve at the initial and the final fit was similar?
Yeah. So if we fit that, the area under that was comparable to the area under the red line here.
So you're going to explain why that's slower?
No, just...
I just want to ask questions, like I was pressing there. Because it looks like you're doing it slower, but they're not keeping up, actually. The slower
right.
The move, the slower they move.
And the structure was relaxing.
Right. So
it's not relaxing because they have the same amount.
No. They're still kink bands, but they're not as far tilted over. So as we shear, the stuff in the kink band goes like this, and you know, goes past 90 degrees, and they're still in the kink band, but they're not as far rotated over.
So you're saying that if I leave it at that position for a while, it will turn back?
Oh, yes, that is what I'm saying. That is exactly what I'm saying.
Do you see that?
Yes. Oh, not with, well, let's just wait till we get to the relaxation stuff. Okay. Now, Justin.
The top of, on the kind of right-hand end,
uh-huh.
I think the curves, the canonical curves always be higher than the theoretical curves. Is there a reason? Is that just fitting or?
Oh, golly, we thought a lot about this, but I forget what the answer was. There's something funny about this, but I don't remember what it is. And see, this is 120. Yeah, so you're going to start to see, okay, I remember now. Some of that asymmetry comes from this big hunkin' beam stop, where we've clipped over there and we haven't clipped over here. So there's asymmetry. So 120 degrees is not the same as minus 60 degrees. So that's one. So that's why this data isn't the same intensity as this data.
Scattering over the
number
should be the same this way as this way.
Right. So right. All right. So there's lamellar rotation for the lamellae inside the kink band. There's also rotation of the lamellae in the predominantly parallel starting state. So this is from an earlier experiment where this is the predominantly parallel starting state. We're shearing to the higher azimuthal angles. That's the vorticity direction, but you see this peak maximum is going in the anti-vorticity direction by a couple degrees. And that we understand also in terms of rotation of the lamellae, in terms of pile-up. So the rate at which they're going to rotate is going to depend on what the orientation is. Right? Just like it did in the kink band, but now we're talking about the stuff in the parallel orientation, and the stuff that is more upright like this, which is kind of in this region and this region, is going to rotate more quickly. And the stuff that is really close to being perfectly aligned will rotate more slowly. There's a smaller driving force. And that gives rise to this pile-up just short of being aligned. So, pile-up. These guys are rotating fast, slower. Sorry, these guys are rotating slower, slow, faster. So, the caboose is catching up with the engine. We're having a train wreck. Okay. So now let's talk about termination where, not in a rheometer, but in a home-built shearing device, we were able to go to higher strains. And now we see how the kink bands die. So the kink bands, well, this is one strain unit. We have these nice, tilt boundaries. As we go to higher strains, we get these omega-type boundaries. Yeah. Somebody else named them Omega. Somebody else has named them Omega, right? So, so if you want to study Omega boundaries, this is a great way to make a lot of them. Make kink bands and just strain past that. Now, again, we would love to be able to interpret these undulations, but again, these are TEM, so these are thin microtome sections, and this looks like waviness in a microtome section, but maybe it's not. Maybe it is real.
Well, is it correlated with the periodicity in the omega boundary? Mm-hmm. It kind of looks like.
Yeah, it kind of. Yeah, so these, are rotating. Mm-hmm. If that was going to be pursued, we would just have to do it a lot. We'd have to take a bunch more images to really convince ourselves that we could measure those undulations. Now, remember, these are also sheared at a high temperature and quenched to room temperature. So that may have happened during the quenching. All right, so at higher strains, the boundaries transform from chevrons into omegas, and omegas with little extensions, omegas with little dots.
So is it a good way of think of this as this king band split into an array of something?
Well, at this point, we're still calling it kink bands because we still have parallel rows of defects and tilted stuff in the middle. So you can see that this we're going to describe this angle theta in this set of experiments, but that theta is going to keep getting smaller. But I would still, you know, it's a.
Would the undulations show up in the X-ray
data? We'd have to have many, many. I don't think so.
It's just broadening.
Right. Yeah. And you couldn't separate the broadening from, you know, this tilt boundary and that tilt boundary, this orientation versus that orientation versus undulations. Right.
So what's the distribution of W's?
What's the distribution of?
Weights.
Well, we're all about half a micron. I mean, but when we've measured this, it's you know, it's like from 0.3 to 1. For every, you know, we look at high molecular weight styrene ethylene propylenes. The kink bands are always about half a micron, which, you know, but that's kind of the, for an edge dislocation, that's kind of how long it takes to bend over it, right? So that spacing doesn't strike me as being totally arbitrary, but it's just related to the bending energy of this block of polymer.
So the structure on the right has mm-hmm. things like dislocations in it, except,
I still think of these as tilt boundaries.
So what are the bits in between those, you know, line segments there?
Right. They are broken off from the white, which is the styrene domain in these images.
There's a critical angle, like 60 degrees above which we begin to see that.
Right. We'll
so
see.
You're bringing the two of the things to close.
Right. We'll see that in a minute. So if we go further, you know, we're still getting omega boundaries. They get long. We still have the extensions and the dots. And then after a while, at 10 strain units, they break. So now you can see all the ends. But there's still a few omegas going around, but we get more and more breaking. So we looked at a bunch of, not an infinite number, we looked at some defects, and we put them on this plot where, ooh, now I have to remember the symbols. All right. These are the ones from the quiescent sample, no strain applied. The triangles are chevrons, and the diamonds are omega boundaries. So that's this tilt angle, right? So as the angle of the boundary gets tighter, you see a transformation from chevron to omegas, and it's about 60 degrees. And then as we strain, you know, so for one strain unit, there were a bunch of chevrons and only a few boundaries that had omegas. But the ones that showed the omega boundaries had a tighter angle. And then on and on. The squares then are where we start to see breaking. And you can see by the time we get to strain units, most of them are broken. All right, so you can kind of see two things from this data. As you strain, the window here, that angle gets tighter. And that's consistent with the lamellae inside the kink band rotating over. All right. We also see that the chevrons always have a more open angle than the omegas, but that crossover point, which is shown by the bar, increases. So as you're putting in strain, that critical angle where you transform from chevron to omega goes up. So more open. So the way to think about this is think of something at, you know, 70 degrees. Here it's a chevron. And here, it's an omega, because it's not a quiescent state. You've actually applied a strain.
Are you sure it goes up? I mean, couldn't you say it just occurs at the same tilt angle?
Bar, 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 bar? That looks like it's going up to me.
Yeah, but for particularly the last bar, you could put anywhere between these.
Fine. Right. So if we looked at another 100 defects, we might change that a bit. But it seems to make sense to me. This is the one that I find convincing, just because there's a lot of data on that one.
Where does Mark Messon predict the transformation, or is it very sensitive to the parameters? So Mark Messon uses itself
right.
as the field theory.
Right, so actually that's on the next.
Before you go back, suppose you started, say, with an angle of 120 degrees for a given kink band and then took Dave's kink band rotation model, you could compute where that kink band is going to evolve. What would that line look like, that family of lines?
Oh, golly. I don't know. I don't know.
Well, they all approach zero asymptotically, but beyond that, we don't know.
Well, you could easily...
That's true. Yeah.
Just integrate. Yeah. My guess is that those would fall off a lot faster than the data are falling down. So that something is retarding the intense strain units is a lot for any sort of
rotation. But this is the slowest strain unit where Dave's model was least effective.
Yeah.
Okay. So this data actually predated the work that Dave and I did together. All right. So chevrons, intermediates, omega boundaries, and so there is a boundary transformation as that angle gets tighter. So it's not so the results in the kink bands aren't unreasonable given this. Yeah.
How do you find a difference
quantitatively? This image is from Mattson's work. I don't remember how he distinguished this from this. It might just be that the curvature doesn't vary uniform. There's an inflection here, and then here there's. I don't know what the difference is.
That is, in the omega, the period of the boundary actually changes, doesn't it? I'm wrong. The black ones are all still identical. But the black ones are distinguishable from the white ones.
Right. So here, black and white are still indistinguishable. But there's a point of inflection.
In his simulation, does the LSC breaking off so that you get like a little?
I don't know. I don't think he does see breaking off. I stand corrected. He does see breaking off when these two numbers, which are like the Kunz-Stipp length, are not the same. Because then you have preference for breaking in one or the other. My understanding is that the white and black here are interchangeable. It's just there's some instability that makes it happen in black sometimes and white other times. But they're identical in every way. Same volume fraction, same Kunz-Stipp. But if these two get different and this gets different, then you can see break off. Yeah.
But in your experiment, volume fraction is 50-50?
Let me check the material. This one is not. It's not 50-50. So it's 40 over 110. So it's, I don't know, 38 or something. The weight, these are nominal molecular weights, and the weight fraction is very close to the volume fraction in this system.
But that means you can induce some transition to cylindrical structure.
Oh, in those boundaries where I got the dots.
Yeah, you
remember that in theory, Kunz-Stipps are always identical, and in practice, they sometimes quite different. So
right.
In the middle of the Weller phase.
Right. So in the paper where we show this data, we connect a little bit more in more detail than I'm doing here with that piece of work. Okay. Let's talk about relaxation in kink bands. So now, after you have a host of kink bands, what happens if you let it sit around for a little bit? So this is, the relaxation studies we've done have been on this sample. So a plethora of conjugate kink bands. If you anneal that for 2 hours, you get this. So the first thing you see is that those tight boundaries soften out. So the Z sort of shape softens back into an S. These tilt boundaries have gotten broad. All right, so that sharpness that we see is because, you know, we're in shear and we've quenched it quickly enough from shear. But if you let it relax, and thank God block copolymers are sluggish, so we can actually, you know, capture this intermediate.
I didn't appreciate that. Does it settle? Okay, so equilibrium mechanics suggests that there's a well-defined length for that for a given boundary. And you're saying that you think that, that in shear, you're getting something that's narrower than what I get just by doing the mechanics of equilibrium?
Absolutely.
Okay. And
absolutely.
Does it settle down for a while? You know, does it approach the kind of width and then eventually?
No, we don't know. We don't know. Because now the fact that we have this variety of kink bands, there's a variety of angles between these, how that's going to relax out would be a really hard thing to quantify. We don't know, okay, we don't know at 2 hours how much the lamellae inside here has changed from an electron microscopy experiment, and we have not done a in situ anneal in the X-ray. Yeah, that's the experiment that Begg's doing. Uh-huh. Now, these are different fields of view. You know, right, they're samples with, you know, equivalent histories. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, if we anneal longer, then we get the things that start to take on names other than kink bands. See, after 2 hours, you could still see parallel boundaries, but the boundaries were soft rather than sharp. So, you know, we might still have, maybe that's a former kink band, but we start to get these other things where it's really just wrapping around, right? So this reminds me of some of the drawings that were on the board yesterday, you know. If that's a defect running out of the board and maybe there's another one, then you know, they start to look like racetracks or thumbprints. And then after a much longer anneal, all we have are these, you know, broad changes in orientation.
Whorls.
Hmm?
For fingerprints, they're called whorls.
Whorls. We have whorls. Now, I used to just say these were focal conics, but here I was more vague than that. U-shaped defects. And we've actually seen this one other time. So Ron Larson and I published a paper together. I don't even remember what the condition of the sample was, but if we annealed it, we started to see focal conic sort of defects, or we started to see curvy things with, you know, singularities in the center. Yeah. So we haven't explored this very extensively, but it'd be interesting to see how a kink band that goes zing, zing, zing ends up going like this at some point.
Is there a way you can assign a length that's evolving? You start with something fairly sharp, and can you look at the radius? You know, if you look at your 2 hour, 24 hour, you know, 1 week, and so forth, can you talk about the evolution of the radius of curvature at one of these typical locations? I know you can't take the same
region. Well, not so much here, because I can't even tell where the kink band was.
Well, there, you identify like a separation between defects, which that can also be very.
Well, that's a different length. I was thinking radius of curvature, the typical place where kink.
Yeah.
Distribution of curvature.
Exactly. You can measure the evolution of distribution of radii of curvature.
Right, but it wouldn't. So the question is whether this radius is influenced by the fact that there's a row of tilt boundaries here and a row of tilt boundaries there. You know, is this curvature influenced by the fact that there's this over here and that the stuff inside here is, you know, tilting over like that?
Yeah.
So we haven't. All what we concluded from this is the first kink band paper, was that if you anneal them, they're going to go away.
Basically, what you see is, in the beginning, you start with kink bands.
Yeah.
And then you have a lattice, you have a distribution of singularities.
Right.
Therefore, you can postulate that these kink bands somehow decay into breakdown through the nucleation of some of these singularities.
Right. Now, right, so I like that postulate a lot. I'm not sure. I'd have to think more about whether there's a way to get at that experimentally, but I think the way to get at it would be scattering rather than imaging, because you have continuous time. And I actually wonder whether kink bands could possibly exist in regular smectic systems, but we never capture them because they relax so quickly right into something like this. So that's where it really gets interesting for me. It's when I think about this image is, how do you go from, well, not even that one, the one with conjugate kink bands into this? And is that something that happens all the time, every day, in faster relaxing systems?
The process by which, I guess, this could relax either by having, you might imagine just having the curvature spread, yeah. But there, you know, but if you look at the energetics, there's a preferred curvature. And so another way, so you think it would spread for a while and then just get stuck because it's minimizing free energy locally. But if the whole structure tilted, the width of the kink bands goes up as the angle goes down. So it's, you might ask if the broadening of the kink bands is coupled to a change in the, you know, to just decrease the angle of all the kink bands.
Right, right. So that, again, if we took our in-situ experiments, because we shear to 80% and then we always come back to zero and we can see that peak move back, but if we just sheared out to 80 and waited, what would happen first?
One rheological experiment that might be interesting is to strain to some population of kink bands in that bucket recovery of that strain. Is the time scale of this relaxation, if you try to extract a characteristic time and then compare that with the shear rate where you started to see deviations from David's theory, is that there's some consistency in that?
I haven't thought about that.
How low was that shear rate where you saw deviation? 0.001
or 0.01? Right. Well, a little bit of deviation from 0.01, but considerable deviation at 0.01.
Yeah. Your first point in this experiment is 2 hours.
Yeah.
7,000 seconds. So, I mean, you're not.
Yeah. Okay. So if we just take a block of polymer and cast it, no, we don't see these types of defects. We're not to this extent. You might see them occasionally, but if you look at Guido's, Sam's, quiescent annealed lamellar block of polymers, he doesn't see a lot of these. I'm not saying they don't exist there, but we can make a lot of them. We can make it the predominant defect.
What about cooling from the orders?
Well, at these high molecular weights, we can't get into ODT, above the ODT. Okay, so I want to talk about, that's it for kink bands. That's all we know. That's all we know. And the part we understand least is the relaxation.
How do we prepare?
How do we prepare?
Kink bands.
If you want kink bands, you want them all in this, you want all forward or do you want conjugate kink bands?
All forward.
All forward. So all forward, you get a modestly defective sample. It depends on molecular weight. So, and I don't know whether anyone can just write it down ahead of time. So in our high molecular weights, we do a very light oscillatory shear to knock out the big defects, and then we do a higher oscillatory shear to knock out the next population of defects. If we went straight to large amplitude oscillatory shear in one of these high molecular weight samples, then we get the conjugate kink bands. So it's important to ramp up the oscillatory shear to reduce the number of residual defects so we don't get kink bands locking into one another and persisting. And sometimes solvent casting is enough to get something that's predominantly parallel. But if you want forward kink bands, just get something that's predominantly parallel, but not defect-free, and then shear it in one direction.
I want to understand the driving force for the relaxation of the kink band. So if we take this three-deck picture
yeah.
that they proposed, you have a fixed thickness of the sample, right?
Yeah.
And when you shift this deck, you have to do this. So that means that you have to create, the strain has to be absorbed by the surrounding. And is it reasonable to assume that is that long range compression and dilation that eventually...
It's constant spacing. All the strain is at the boundary.
No, but you're shifting the position of the deck.
Right. Right.
Yeah, but then you have other domains that do the opposite.
If I follow a single lamellar through the sample, it used to be straight, and it's not systematic tendency to tilt.
Okay, the thing is, it never was straight. The thing is, it was never straight. So it's hard to think about unless you can think of many interacting defects.
Well, no, I mean, if it was straight, if a typical lamellar was straight on average, it didn't systematically wander up or down as you went from the left to the right of the sample. That's been modified. As it goes through kink bands, it goes down.
Yeah, right.
It's my right. Problem. There could be a macroscopic stress setup.
Ralph and I tried to, I sent Lay out to Ralph's lab, I think once or maybe twice, to actually try and measure it. But getting a reliable starting state proved we could not reproduce a normal stress measurement.
Okay. So, you know, if you took the omega boundary state and mm-hmm. then tried to persuade it to relax a little bit more than spontaneously by small amplitude oscillatory strain, does it eventually decompose into just become and become grain boundaries, or does it stay omega?
I don't know. Didn't do that.
One quick comment about the initiation of these things. If you take this model, if you take this pre-deck of cards model, and extrapolate it backwards in time, there is a state in which the pre-deck of cards are flat. Okay? But throughout the whole progression of the model, the rate of shear, the direction of shear is opposite inside the kink band than it is in the matrix. That is, if I think of each of these chevrons, I think of pulling two decks of cards together, this one shearing this way, and this one, the other one shearing the opposite sense. And so that the model has that feature throughout, even when it's flat. That is, in order to start moving up, you have to have a reverse direction of shear inside the kink band. Another sort of drastic feature is if you look at the same tension in the kink band, it actually diverges as you go to flat. Okay. So just to comment that something, the early state, the model blows up. The early stages. Is there some drastic transformation where you reverse the state of shear inside of a kink band before any of this can apply? And we don't understand that early stage at all.
Also, if you take a 45-degree boundary orientation, then you cannot go above 90 degrees. That plane cannot go.
No, actually, both the model and the data goes past 90. The stuff in the kink band goes past 90.
While maintaining a 45-degree.
No, there's this angle we can only get at from electron microscopy, and it's about 45 degrees. This angle of the stuff inside,
right.
That can go, I don't know, I think we see it go to 100 degrees.
No, there's a contradiction between the observations and the model there. In the model, that angle, the angle of the tilt boundary always bisects the two.
Right, right.
In order to maintain constant layer stress.
Right.
So that has a boundary.
Oh, and actually, if we go to the very high strains, right, so in an early paper, we'd only gone to one strain unit, and it was always about 45. But in the experiments that where we started to see in the omega boundaries, they were more over. Okay, so can I still do a word about contraction? Or a few words? Okay, so lamellar contraction. So now we're going to look at the stuff that's in the predominantly parallel starting state. So we're looking at the main peak, not that shoulder moving. We have lots of higher order, so we can reliably get the periodicity. So three different block copolymers in this study with periodicities from 45 to 109 nanometers. So this is now looking at the periodicity relative to the initial periodicity as a function of strain, and we can see that as we shear faster, red, black, and blue, as we shear faster, we get a larger contraction, and the amount of contraction also is highest for the high molecular weight and smallest for the lowest molecular weight, where, you know, this is negligible, right? So that's the one bit of data. We can simultaneously take stress strain, and where we see the highest amount of contraction corresponds to the highest amount of shear stress necessary to do that. Right, so now this is the one block of polymer again for the three shear rates, and higher shear rate, the higher stress. This is just as a function of molecular weight. So all at the same shear rate, low, medium, high molecular weight, low, medium, high molecular weight. And just this is a dramatic difference in strain, right? It's a couple orders of magnitude. All right, so when we think about layer contraction, well, we know why the equilibrium lamellar spacing is this balance between interfacial and stretching energy of the chains. And for the lamellae to contract, there has to be a distortion in the chain conformation. There's really no other way around it. So if the periodicity is going to change, there has to be a change in the chain conformation. So if we think of increasing the shear rate, if you shear faster, there's less time for relaxation. So if there's less relaxation, there's more distortion, so there's more contraction. So these are all nice qualitative arguments. And similarly, if there's higher molecular weight, there's more entanglement. If there's more entanglement, there's more distortion because you're pulling on the chains more if they're more highly entangled, as opposed to sliding past one another. All right, so again, that justifies or, you know, qualitatively describes the increase in molecular weight corresponding to more contraction. But when we think about the constraints, so we don't need to put these both up here at the same time. So this is the styrene, you know, ethylene, propylene, so the black and blue blocks of the diblock polymer. So there's that green block is covalently bonded to that black block. Right? So when I think about the block copolymer, I actually think about it in multiple layers that aren't necessarily related to the compositional gradient. So here the compositional gradient is green, black, green, black. But we want to think about the how the conformations are going to change. And so the amount of strain that's taken up in the interpenetration zone can be different than the amount of strain taken up in this region, or the amount of strain taken up in this interpenetration zone can be different than that interpenetration zone. Right, so this is just one way of saying this is really, really complex. And I've actually thought about it more. I've actually thought that if we allow the green chains to contract less or more than the black chains, this strain doesn't even have to be uniform here, right? There could be more strain in this green one than there is in this black one. And I can draw that. So the constraint is that the area projunction has to be the same. So I'm just going to draw the block copolymer as a rectangle. And there's our junction. And if we allow more contraction there and less contraction there, I think we can do that. I used to think that wasn't possible, but I wonder whether this is possible. The area of these two has to be the same. But I think you can draw two things that have the same area but haven't tilted to the same extent. All right, so now we can look at the strain profile across here. There'll be a strain of the black, there'll be the strain of the black interpenetration, there'll be a strain of the green and a strain of the green interpenetration. So, and then just the last slide is, if we take that contraction, the relative contraction as a function of stress, it falls, you know, more or less on a universal curve, right? So the more stress that's applied, the larger the contraction, right? So this is a log scale of stress. So these are the ones that show almost no contraction, and then for the higher molecular weights and the higher strains, we got larger contractions, but those are also the ones that showed higher stress.
So the ones that contracted significantly all came from the highest molecular weight sample?
Right, the red ones are all the highest molecular weight. Low, medium, high strain. But, you know, the black one showed some contraction as well. So the Williams and McIntosh model, you know, if we fit that set of data, we'll get a very different set of numbers than if we, you know, fit that set of data. And we can't actually get that curve to go through this whole master curve of data. So we have some interesting data. We describe it qualitatively in the discussion because that was we had no way of separating out the local strain within the glycopolymer. We knew it wasn't uniform, but that was all we could do. Okay.
Like actually have a lunch.
Yeah.
You can't actually approach them with like the amplifier.